interview with Ambassador Ghassan Twaini in his offices in Beirut, Lebanon, on March 17th, 1998, and I'm Jean Krasno. So, for the record, Ambassador Twaini, would you explain something about your background? Were you born and educated, and when you began your role with the UN?
Yes, I was born in Lebanon in 1926, and I was my higher studies were done at the American University of Beirut, and I graduated with a BA in philosophy in 1945. And I had done my secondary studies mostly at the French section of the American University of Beirut. Hence, I can speak in both. I learned to learn both languages, French and English, over a lot of my Arabic languages, which is my national language. Mm-hmm. I then went to Harvard University with the hope of acquiring a doctor's degree, which I failed to complete because my father died and I had to come back and take over the family business, which is the newspaper we're sitting in today. I finished with an MA in government, I was hoping to write a dissertation on political philosophy, particularly his philosophy of liberty, Immanuel Kant. But I think this is all you need to know. Now, I was not really preparing to become a journalist, which I am, which I inherited. Yeah. I was hoping to return to America and go into teaching. I had another choice, which was to try the foreign service of my country, but family imperatives forced me to stay. And I've been in this business for 50 years now. But during the 50 years, I had numerous inroads in public life. I was elected member of parliament very few years after I came back from America, and then I was another mandate at the House, Deputy Speaker of the House, mostly in opposition. And then I became a member of the cabinet in 1970. For a short while, I resigned after, and then I went to the UN on a number of missions, mainly in 1967, when the first Arab-Israeli war broke. Maybe because I had been a war correspondent. This was my first assignment as a journalist. I went to the Arab forces into Palestine right after the partition, while the partition was taking place. Then I remained here. I became another primary member of government in 1975, so for a number of years. 2 years really, until 1977. This was the conclusion of the first phase of our war, called civil war, which it wasn't. And there was a change of president in 1977, and the new president sent me as ambassador to the UN in September 1977. And I stayed there until September 1982. Resigned and returned with the end of the mandate of the President Yasser. So I served at the UN for 6 solid years. Mm. And I returned here and have been working as a journalist for a long, with a short intermezzo as political advisor to the President, being the President of the Republic between 82 and 84.
Okay, excellent.
But I never interrupted my interest and my work as a journalist, even when I was in New York.
Even when you were in New York?
Yes.
Well, I'd like to actually start with the time that you spent in New York, and then we may go forward and then, you know, take a look at the history as well.
I thought we were going to concentrate on New York and the UN.
Yes, and that's what we'll look at first.
Okay.
Yes. So you were at the UN at the time of the writing of the Security Council resolution 425 and 426,
yes,
which created UNIFIL. Can you
give
a little
an
background?
Active part, yes.
Some background and leading up to that, and then what meetings took place and how those resolutions evolved.
Sure. The background is very, very important, and I will insist on two things. The first is that the Lebanese borders were the only borders with Israel where there was no UN presence of any form, with the exception of UN observers, truce observers. This is the organization which was really observing the implementation of the armistice of 1948.
Right.
But it wasn't operative, and the Lebanese-Israeli border was the only border where there was active movement, namely active warfare. Not really full-fledged warfare, but ins and outs of Israel and various acts of aggression, acts of violence on the border.
Yeah.
Whereas there was none of this on other Arab borders, mm-hmm. with the exception of the war of attrition on the Egyptian border.
Yeah.
One or two operations in Jordan. But I mean, this was the most constantly active border.
Yeah.
So much so that many of us considered, used the word that the Lebanese borders were summing up Arab wars against Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And this despite the fact that the Lebanon was the only country that hadn't declared war on Israel. And it was the most Pacific, peace-loving country, etc., etc. This is one part in the background.
Yeah.
Another part in the back, and we did not take an active part in the 1967 war,
right?
Which after which Israel declared the armistice agreement of 1948 has finished.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as obsolete, use the legal term. We never accepted the theory that the armistice agreement had ceased existing legally, at least.
Mm-hmm.
Second background is that when I got to New York in 1977, September 1977,
mm-hmm.
there had been acts of aggression against Israel, against Lebanon from Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And the first point I had, the very first meetings that I had with the responsible people in the Secretariat and some delegates of countries particularly concerned,
mm-hmm.
Point on the agenda was, can we in some way bring UN forces on the Lebanese border? What was decided was to increase the UNSCOR, the observers' corps.
Yeah.
But okay. The observers were in any way not active, so there was no use increasing their number. Putting UN soldiers on the Lebanese border was one of the most important issues in Lebanese politics. There was a deep cleavage between various opinions and factions in the Lebanon. Those who wanted UN soldiers to enforce or preserve some form of peace on the border, and why should there be war,
mm-hmm.
and those who did not want. Now, one has to bear in mind that Lebanon is the country that received second to Jordan, which was more or less a geographic continuation of Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
Lebanon was the country that received the largest contingent of Palestinian refugees in 1948, and still another important contingent in 1970 who came from Jordan after Black September.
Right.
And we were nurturing in Lebanon, much against our will, but there was a movement of enthusiasm for them. We were nurturing what I have done very often, and I claim the copyright, a diaspora in revolt. Nowhere else was the Palestinian diaspora really in revolt, armed to the teeth,
mm-hmm.
very well equipped, with heavy equipment. And the Palestinian camps had turned into really military contingents.
Yeah.
The Lebanese government had signed, or was forced to sign, with Israel, with the Palestinians in 1968, a so-called Cairo agreement, because it was signed in Cairo, regulating the relations between the Palestinians, namely the Palestinian guerrillas, because they became guerrillas,
mm-hmm.
and the Lebanese government, the limits of Lebanese sovereignty, and whether do we give door extract the illegality from Palestinian Authority inside the camps, and is there a Hoshinit trail by which they can go towards the Israeli border and shoot their Katyushas or go into infiltrate into Israel and conduct operations?
No, you say that you were forced into this agreement, the Cairo agreement.
Yes.
In what way, what were the pressures on Lebanon?
Well, two sides of pressure. First, the power that the Palestinians had acquired inside Lebanon, a solidarity almost universal, but certainly a majority of people who thought were seduced by the Palestinian revolution, thought that the revolution was really going to bring back the stolen land to the Palestinians, or take back the Palestinians into Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
And the Palestine Liberation Movement, the PLO, which had its constituency all over the world, had the highest constituency in the Lebanon.
Okay.
Secondly, it infiltrated inside Lebanese politics and had become a platform for opposition, for a certain opposition, and a reinforcement of Muslims against Christians. The Lebanese society is a conflictual society, it is plural, or pluralistic, and it was easy to infiltrate into this conflictual society, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So we were forced by both the acquired position of the Palestinians inside Lebanon, their allies, public opinion, etc., and the support they were getting against the Lebanese government. Whenever the Lebanese government said, okay, stop here, you're violating the law, you're creating problems for the Lebanon. The Arab countries were all too happy that the Palestinians were operating from Lebanon and not from their own country.
Okay.
They were sending arms, particularly Syria. And I'm not sending an accusation here, I'm only repeating what Syria itself acknowledged with a certain sense of pride, that they were arming the camps.
Yeah.
The Palestinians didn't have the means of buying all the hardware, all armaments they had, and these were given to them by Syria, Libya, Iraq, Egypt, everybody.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Wittingly, knowing that they probably would be used against the Lebanese, but so what? I mean, nobody really was concerned that this was weakening the Lebanese state, because the Lebanese state was not very popular with other Arabs all the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there was pressure from
within
and
from
without.
So there was pressure, and when once there was a major clash between the Palestinians and the Lebanese army, the Arabs sent a goodwill mission here, and then the chairmanship of the Second General Arab League and six foreign ministers, etc., etc., and we had to sign the Cairo Agreement in 1960. But the Cairo Agreement was not operative by the time we signed it. The Palestinians had overflooded the camps, and their presence all over the country was notorious. And there were new clashes, and at one time, paradoxically, implementing the Cairo Agreement was a Lebanese demand rather than a Palestinian demand. We wanted them to return to the limits of the Cairo Agreement, but glad if we could limit them to the Cairo Agreement. And the so-called civil war of 1975 was born from a clash between Palestinians and Lebanese.
Okay.
So this is the background.
That's the background.
Yes. Now, against this backdrop, I went to the UN.
Yes.
It was the most difficult mission.
Yeah.
Lebanese diplomacy were totally crippled. And this is why they chose a politician, if you wish, or a man of politics and information, rather than a career diplomat, because he would enjoy greater authority, more freedom of action, probably will be more detached in talking to the Palestinians at the UN and to the Arabs, and trying to say once again, or once, to say again, Lebanon is my country, not yours, and we decide what we want to do, you don't decide.
Yeah.
When we got there, what to do about Lebanon was decided by the Arab group. So, well, the question of bringing UN forces to the Lebanon before the Israeli invasion in 1978 was discussed in great secrecy, but was discussed. And even then, I could not get an agreement of the Lebanese government to ask for UN troops on the border, despite the mounting pressure for this in some Lebanese circles, particularly the leader of the opposition, official opposition, Raymond Abdi, who was all the time clamoring that we should have blue helmets, as he called them.
Okay, so that was the group that favored the UN.
Yes, sure.
And so what were the reasons that that group favored having a UN?
Because they wanted to stop the clashes on the border.
Okay.
And we got clashes on the border. The theory is, the mathematics of it, if you will, the numbers was this, that we had come to the point where it was the backlash from Israel on Lebanese villages, etc., etc., including an air raid on the Lebanese airport, was more costly to the Lebanon than where the Palestinian attacks on Israel. Mm-hmm. So, say we would shoot a Katyusha to Israel, it had a tremendous useless value. There was not peace, no stability anymore in northern Israel, but Israeli retaliation was so much total disproportion, and it was very costly, and it was destroying Lebanese villages, Lebanese homes, Lebanese houses, and there was a new wave of refugees. The Palestinians had already been refugees from Palestine, and they were now getting into Beirut because they didn't want to stay in the camps and receive retaliation. Mm-hmm. But Lebanese as well were emigrating.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole Lebanese society was disrupted, and there was a tremendous economic problem. Lebanon was really falling apart.
So what groups didn't want the UN on the border?
Well,
why?
The more outspoken pro-Palestinians.
Okay.
They thought, so what? I mean, this is war against Israel, let's wage it from where we can.
Yeah, okay.
And there was a slogan which was utterly stupid, said by some Palestinians. Why should we worry about Beirut being destroyed when Yaffa, Haifa, and Jerusalem have been destroyed already? So one more city. Uh-huh. So what? I mean, this is a war of liberation. It's going to be forever, whatever.
Okay.
You know, I mean, this whole romantic. This was the era of romantic liberation movements.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Right.
Go ahead.
Okay. So then, what transpired in New York at UN headquarters in these discussions?
Nothing much, you know. There was this discussion, and then it was shelved. But it wasn't really shelved because it stayed in the background until March 14. 1978 or March 15, when there was this major operation by the Palestinians in Tel Aviv, which was the first really military operation, because a group of Palestinians disembarked on Israeli soil in Tel Aviv and went hunting, and there was the bus attack, and 34 or so were killed. Israel would retaliate, which it did.
Yeah.
And as usual, Israeli retaliation was not commensurate with the attack. It was much more, and I can't believe for a moment that they, in 24 hours, planned and carried the so-called Litani operation. This must have been their contingency plans. They were waiting for the occasion.
Right.
And they invaded Lebanon up to the Litani, up to the Litani River.
Okay.
So and we believe this is in Israeli, dans le subconscient Israeli, in the Israeli subconscious soul. This was, you know, the implementation of a long-standing claim and dream. Maybe to get to the waters of the Litani, because when the borders of Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria were drawn, the Israelis or the Jewish agency was very displeased, and there were memoranda by Weizmann and others saying that if Israel is to be given means of livelihood in the future, a Jewish home was to be given means of livelihood, it had to have the Litani Water in South Lebanon. They never accepted the border between Lebanon and Palestine.
Yeah, so water becomes a very key issue.
Sure, water was already a key issue, yeah. And it was unveiled or confirmed by the fact that they named their operation retaliation, Operation Litani.
Litani. So then, with this...
Litani is the name of the major river.
Of the river, yes. Right. So with these things happening on the ground here in Lebanon, how did that affect New York, what was going on in New York?
Not much. My instructions, or let's say my line of conduct, which was approved by the president here and the foreign minister to the extent, the president had greater leeway and wanted more. The foreign minister had to play balance politics. Mm-hmm. Was that we, A, should recapture Lebanese initiative at the UN, be our own captain of the ship, and try to see how we can salvage as much as we can Lebanese integrity and independence, freedom of action, and try and see how we can evolve the UN in reducing tensions and somehow acquiring for Lebanon a certain measure of peace, because I mean, I was getting there after the first phase of the war. Lebanon had been witnessing, or had been the theater between 75 and 78 of a major confrontations between Palestinians and Lebanese factions, which had divided the country and created two governments, etc.
Now, at the same time in 1978, the Camp David Accords were coming together.
Not at the same time, after.
After.
Yes.
But the preliminaries were coming together.
Yes.
And how did that event have an effect on the...
It did, but first let us say about 24, let's see about 425.
Okay.
There was the invasion.
Yeah.
And the natural thing was to go to Security Council.
Yeah.
The Lebanon was hesitant to go to Security Council. Mm-hmm. And he hesitated for 24 hours, not really assessing what the importance of the invasion was. Okay. Whereas there was this drive by Arab opinion and the Arab states and the Arab ambassadors at the UN, we go to the Security Council and yell as usual. Mm-hmm. And my government's policy and my policy, it was more or less, this is a time where form was of the essence, depending on how we played.
Uh-huh.
We played it very, very loud. And I said, okay, this is the time for us to get a Security Council resolution, which is action-oriented. We didn't want rhetoric. We had a collection of rhetoric resolutions, condemning Israel, calling for peace, withdrawal from occupied territories, etc., etc.
Yeah.
And there were two tendencies inside the Arab group, the group of Arab ambassadors, and which was a mirror of the Arab states, Arab governments.
Sure.
One tendency was violent condemnation of Israel, and the tendency of Lebanon, with the support of some Arabs, but very timidly, was to try and see how we can use this window of opportunity into structuring a new practical situation on the border. And I won. I mean, I said, look, if you want, you introduce a resolution. I told the Egyptians and the Syrians particularly, who were yelling very loud, you introduce a resolution in the Security Council asking for the condemnation of Israel. But my instructions are to introduce a resolution, to see to it. I could not. Introducing a resolution that would bring forth the withdrawal of Israel and the establishment of peace on the border. Not a peace agreement with Israel, a reinstating the armistice between Israel and Lebanon.
All right, now what countries were on the Security Council that you could work with in order to...
Well, I thought I could work with the Kuwaiti, because he was the Arab group representative.
Okay.
But he wasn't really... we weren't seeing eye to eye, because a Kuwaiti has to have an eye on Palestinian opinion and Arab opinion. Now, Arab opinion is usually with the more extreme not with the more modest or moderate or moderate.
Yeah.
So he was wavering between supporting the point of view of the Lebanese government, but yet not forgetting what the Palestinians wanted.
Sure. Okay.
And my most difficult point was to deal with the Palestinian representative. He was not on the Security Council, but he was there, he was an observer.
Uh-huh.
And he had, by virtue of the rules of order there, right to come to the Security Council and talk.
Yeah, okay. Who was
in terms
that?
Of governments, the nearest two governments to us were, of course, the Americans and the French.
Okay.
The French by tradition, the Americans because they were the most important and they were concerned about establishing peace, etc. And I had no complexes working with the Americans. Andrew Young was the ambassador, and he had an excellent deputy chief of mission who was an Orientalist, Arabist, a specialist in Arab affairs. Jim Leonard, James Lambert.
Oh, James Leonard.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we worked very closely, and they had a team of great experts. And of course, the government here, the foreign minister here, was discussing with the American ambassador and the French ambassador. The French were all along supporting us fully. And I could not really get away with asking for UN troops myself. Mm-hmm. But I think the Americans played it very subtly. And we agreed finally that they will sponsor the resolution.
Okay.
And Andrew said in his speech that this was the first resolution that the U.S. was sponsoring the Middle East and getting away with, because usually their resolutions were vetoed by the Russians and shot down by the Arabs.
Mm-hmm.
There was a problem talking to the Russian, of course. Yes. Me. No. So we had long talks with Americans, both in Beirut and in New York, and I suspect in Washington as well.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to Washington as well, and the French, and various people were very active. We finally came to the following agreement that the Americans would introduce a resolution. And in my speech at the Security Council, I would indicate that we were prepared to receive UN forces, to accept UN forces.
Mm-hmm.
So I did not really request UN forces.
Mm-hmm.
I did not have the right as a non-member to initiate the resolution.
Right.
The resolution was an American draft.
Mm-hmm.
But negotiations preceded. And we caught a marvelous period, because this was when there was a little rapprochement between the U.S. and Moscow. So the Russians were willing to come along. They had their say on the drafting and the wording of the resolution. They could not vote for because of their long standing problem with the U.N. Secretariat on how much money they owed, and they did not want to be involved in financing the force. So they said, we will abstain, but we will support it. And they spoke in support of the resolution. The resolution was voted unanimously. The British were splendid, of course. The chairman of the Security Council was, the president of the Security Council was the British delegate. He was a parliamentarian as well. He was not a career that we had.
Okay.
So this is important because I could talk him from parliamentarian to apply different rules. And at one time, because the war was still going on, and everybody was making long and long speeches, and they had a list of 14 speakers to go. So I suggested that since we detected an agreement on the resolution, why did we not vote and ask the Secretary General to implement the resolution and then carry on the speeches during the night, which is what happened. The House was meeting, the Council was meeting while the war was going on, while the Israelis were still advancing, killing, destroying, etc., etc., capturing people.
Mm-hmm.
We voted the resolution. We asked the Secretary to go along and implement it, which he did. And then we went on speaking
mm-hmm.
For for the whole night, because, you know, a speech for a member's council is very important, speech for his own constituency, not to influence the vote. And then they had to speak in explanation of the vote, which is another procedure, very lousy procedure, very frustration. Because it gives you time to make two speeches, and they're all boring because they're conventional speeches. I spoke for 5 minutes, 3 minutes. then we had to write the rules, the terms of reference of the force.
Okay.
And we asked the secretary to go and prepare a report, come back with a draft, discuss it with us, namely all the members of the Security Council, and the two parties concerned.
Okay.
Now the Israelis took a very negative stand because they spoke violently against the resolution. They were against the intervention of the Security Council, against the formation of a force, against sending troops to Lebanon, and they were pretending that, in fact, they were in agreement with the Lebanese, that they were there to chase out the Palestinians, to defend Israel, and that they were, what they were doing was really rendering a service to the Lebanese, which is a logic that did not hold its ground, anyway, and did not get them a vote. So there was a unanimous vote against Israel, because the Israelis were pleading, and they had a very, very eloquent man. I was no measure to him. He later became president of the Israeli Republic, Chaim Weizmann. Not Chaim. I've lost my name. Anyway, Mr. Man, not Weizmann. My God, his name is God. We'll find his name in the minutes. Anyway, he became later president, and he was very, very articulate. And he had a number of tricks on his back. He produced a batch of telegrams of support of the Israeli army from a village. I happened to know the village, and he had more signatures than there were inhabitants in that village. Which I said to the council, made him laugh. I couldn't. And then I showed from the New York Times photographs of the Israelis with Lebanese in their village, hands tied behind their backs and mouths shut with sparadrap and eyes, etc. And with Israeli soldiers playing violin while the boys were thrown on the ground. I said, are these the people who sent you telegrams of support, Mr. Herzog?
Yeah.
It was Mr. Herzog.
Chaim Herzog.
Anyway, these are the little remembrances that stuck and stayed with me for, what is it now, 20 years.
So when you say unanimous, the Soviets abstained. Did any other countries abstain?
I think China did not take part in the vote.
And China just didn't take part in the vote.
So they acquiesced. Everybody else resigned.
Okay. Now, the resolution was in two parts, 425
and then
426.
426 was a mandate to the Secretariat, to the Secretary as in charge of the forces, to the terms of reference and the guidelines for the force. And it is the more important resolution done in practical terms, because this is what defined what's going to happen. But 425 was the political decision. It was clear, A, total respect for the international recognized boundaries. And my God, it took hours to negotiate that one line, because there was no recognition of the internationally recognized boundaries of Lebanon by Israel, because they thought that those boundaries should be flexible, etc. So there was establishing this principle was very important. Many Lebanese commentators said that this was the second declaration of independence of Lebanon, because this was the whole world, the Security Council, confirming the borders of Lebanon with Israel.
Okay, so Lebanon wanted that language.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
And then withdrawal forthwith, which is immediate, forthwith, cessation of all hostilities, and then the creation of a force. And the mandate of the force.
Okay. So in the arguments about that language,
yes,
what countries were opposed to specifically that language?
Well, the Russian trend was to be stronger against Israel and to not to have anything that can be used against the Palestinians. With in the back of their mind, probably the possibility of allowing the cities to go on, harassing the Israelis once the pullout was signed. Mm-hmm. And so were the Syrians, of course. But the creation of the area of operation was important because we wanted the area of operation to be the total area where there were problems. Confrontation between Lebanese and Israelis,
okay,
and Lebanese and Palestinians.
Okay. Okay.
Little area was left north of the blue line, north of the border of the Arab operation, which became a no man's land. Mm-hmm. The Lebanese army could not get to it. The Arab deterrent force, which was present in the Lebanon, could not get to or would not get to it, mm-hmm, because the Syrian decision was negative. And it had become really the seat of the extremist Palestinian factions who went on harassing Israel. And I cannot believe that this was innocent. I believe that there was a will to, and probably a meeting of objective, an objective alliance of interests between Israelis and Syrians and Palestinians, that we should leave that a line issue susceptible of being of igniting further conflict, which was the case, because the Israelis had never wanted really to withdraw, and that gave them really the alibi to stay.
Okay.
Maybe the Syrians didn't want to withdraw, because if they withdrew and if there was really a strong presence of UNIFIL, then the war in the Lebanon and the Syrians would withdraw.
Mm-hmm. Now the United States, as you say, sponsored the resolution.
Yes.
They were very anxious.
Introduced and then sponsored.
And then introduced, yes, and then sponsored it. I understand that the U.S. was very anxious for some kind of action to be taken to on the issue, particularly involving Israel, because they were in the process of working on the Camp David.
Sure. They thought that this was really the second Arab country, or the third, because they were counting on Jordan to join, to jump to the bandwagon of Camp David. Mm-hmm. But then there was a major miscalculation, which is being repeated now. The Lebanon cannot really, which was repeated in 1982, mm-hmm, the Lebanon cannot sign a separate peace with Israel while Syria is even theoretically in a state of war. Because Syria can really make the peace inoperative in Lebanon through creating the necessary problems.
Okay. So even today, the linkage with the Golan Heights.
Even today, the linkage today is stronger than it was in 1982 and stronger than it was in 1978.
Okay. So we'll move forward to today and the announcement,
yes,
today a little bit later. But I still want to
yes,
work on the past and what was going
on. The past, there is something that I cannot ignore, which is what some commentators on UN have called a UN public opinion. And the UN is ultimately a community of ambassadors and specialists, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm, secretariat. And it is often ridiculed by New York commentators. And,
mm-hmm.
The press would give it sometimes only three lines coverage, and sometimes it's flashed headlines.
Mm-hmm.
UN public opinion was very much in favor of Lebanon, and very much moved by our action.
Yeah.
And by the fact that for the first time there was a forthcoming, strongly expressed clearly stated Lebanese opinion, which did not go for any blah, blah, blah. I mean, there was no vehemently condemns or strongly condemns Israel for an act of aggression. None of that bullshit.
Yeah.
The resolution is very simple. There was no condemnation of Israel. This is the first resolution against Israel with no condemnation of Israel. So this was read as accepting the objective reality that Israel maybe did this in self-defense, yet it is highly illegal and highly reprehensible. So why? Because if we had said condemn, the word condemn spells anathema of the Americans. America is not prepared to vote any resolution that condemns Israel.
Yeah.
I had them later to vote the resolutions that condemn Israel, but not as often as Arabs would want.
Yeah, okay. So in order to get this resolution passed and not have it subject
we
to
had
the
to
U.S. veto,
to have the simple
have
words and no rhetoric, action-oriented, serving an objective purpose, which is going one step towards peace and giving a means of implementation of what was decided.
Okay.
Not really a platonic revolution, saying everybody goes home, you withdraw, and then goodbye, we voted. No.
Yeah.
We could have done that
and
not send it through.
Yeah.
But that would have meant continued Israeli occupation, more than there was, and continued war, because no rhetoric, I use the word again, no platonic resolution really has enough leverage and enough clout to make an aggressor, whether it is Israel or anybody, withdraw. I mean, they don't withdraw if you simply call upon them to withdraw.
Yeah. Have some leverage.
Yeah, have some leverage and the instrument to confirm withdrawal. So in the mandate of the UN force, it was then to confirm the withdrawal of Israel.
Yes.
Now confirm is not just go and see and say yes, the withdrawal, to really create the instrument of withdrawal.
In order to get a resolution to pass the Security Council, you have to have a majority of nine, but in this case you had unanimous with a couple who's not voting. Did you have to work on delegations? Did you meet with them and discuss the issue and explain the issue?
Then the caucusing, yes.
Yeah, caucusing, yeah.
Yes. Of course. Endless hours, sleepless nights. Given the hour difference between, time difference between Beirut and New York, I was communicating with Beirut all night because it was day here.
Yeah.
And working on the delegates all the day.
Meeting behind the scenes with the
different
delegates. Trying
to see them, visit them individually, talk to them, take a piece of paper and see what they want, what they come for, what can they live with. The wording is very important. This is a kingdom of words.
Yeah, exactly.
A comma is important.
Even a comma is important.
Yes, of course.
Right.
And the Russians, my God, are so good. My God.
No, it was Ambassador Trianovsky.
He was very gentle. And I, knowing some history of Russia, I established a very agreeable communication. And I, all the time, asking him about his ancestors, who rebelled against the Tsar in the December Revolution, who were sent to Siberia. He says, I don't know that. The Prince Trianovsky laughed. I'm not Prince. Once I invited him to go to opera to watch a Lebanese ballet dancer. He said, I don't know any Lebanese ballet dancer. Yes, the Metropolitan Opera. I said, who is that? I said, this is Natalia. She was a Russian who had chosen liberty, as you call it, married a Lebanese. The most famous ballet at that time, ballerina, Natalia. Oh my God. Okay, I forget, she came in very tender. And he laughed and said, Ambassador, you easily can recognize the reasons why I have another commitment to see you.
Right, right. But that kind of dialogue with, yes. and the diplomatic world
yes.
is very important.
Sure, yes.
Yeah.
A community is born there. I mean, this is why I'm speaking of the UN, public opinion, then I should speak of the UN society.
Yeah.
We were more or less living together. Of course, not the 157 ambassadors, but I had somehow, with the help of my wife, and Brian Walker talked about that in his memoirs, we established. I wasn't all the time crusading for Arab causes and whatnot, and boring them. You know, I talk art to them, literature, plead my country's culture and history, and our hopes of peace, and our European character as well. We're not Arabs, you know, as you would say. We're a lot of oil, and a lot of women, talent. And probably I was moderate.
But those kinds of things are important because
sure.
you needed the
sure.
Russians not to veto.
Of course,
yeah.
Of course. I needed the Russians all the time.
Yeah.
I knew when they would not come along, but yet I would play the game. I would try to persuade them. And, I offered